Hey, what's up, everybody? It's J.R. Hamatashin. My new and final collection, You Know It's True, has just come out. So if you're listening to this, I hope you check it out. I mean, this work might inspire you to end your life, but if you're going to do that, why not just put as many of these on the credit card as you can before you go? Help old JR out here, huh?
Yeah, I mean, that's not the worst idea. And then you've got a little something to leave for your heirs.
Who am I joined with?
It's me, Derek Sotak. I wrote, sadly, no fourth collections released recently, but I did write the Field Guide to Nachos, Nachos and You, and Recipes from the Nachronomicon, as well as the now-available role-playing game Grey Caesar Dreaming of My Death.
Derek, everybody knows you're my true heir.
Am I going to end up, like, when you die, are there going to be
That's
a big box that shows up in the mail with 10,000 copies of your books?
That's why you're trying to get all the more product for me. I appreciate it, though.
Uh-huh.
What are we talking about today? We are talking about The Conspiracy Against the Human Race, which sounds like...
Now, the book or the conspiracy in general?
Yeah, I was going to say, it sounds kind of like it could be a fun sci-fi book. But no, we were talking about the Thomas Ligotti nonfiction book, which I got... a long time ago when it came out, 10 years or so ago. So I got an actual hardcover with the original kind of a lonely man, a dark room with a white light and then a man standing there. Who knows what he's doing, being alone.
Yeah, do you know how much that baby's worth now on Amazon?
Are you serious?
Yeah, it's like $1,000 to get a hardcover copy.
I might have found some meaning in life right about now.
There you go.
Is that true?
Yeah, because when I was trying to get a copy, I was like, oh, all right, I'd hope there'd be a cheap one, but nope, it was like 980-something the last I checked.
Well, I'm sure me scribbling all my notes for this episode in the book would not have increased the value. But they
or maybe double the value.
They wouldn't find that out until they open it.
Mm-hmm.
And then it would just be little ink, blue ink pen bracketing words with question marks over it.
I mean, that might increase the value. Like, what's the Simpsons gag? Here's a photo of Sean Connery signed by Roger Moore.
I don't get it.
It's a horror book by Thomas Ligotti.
Oh, I get it. I shouldn't have said I don't get it, because I did get it. I had nothing else to say. So, what's your familiarity with Thomas Ligotti?
Almost nothing. I read The Red Tower, and I have Something for This Town, whatever story is.
Wait, what?
And that's the extent of it.
What's The Red Tower? I don't know that one.
It's a short story about a tower that makes weird stuff that may or may not exist.
Why of all the Ligotti stories did you read that one?
Because on my Kadabra Horror Record subscription, those were the ones that showed up.
Okay. Well, so I've read his first two collections, which is Songs for a Dead Dreamer or something.
Yeah.
And good luck
trying to get a physical copy of those for under multiple dollars
as
well.
There's a Penguin edition now that's pretty cheap.
Oh, there's there? Okay.
Yeah, yeah. And it combines the first two collections of his. That I've read. My Work Is Not Yet Done. I've read a fair amount of his. I probably read over at least 50% of his oeuvre. I have the whole...
You like that Work Is Not Yet Done, right?
Yeah, I did. It's actually a story, which is very un-Ligotti-like. I mean, I'm also somewhat sympathize with his sensibilities. I mean, in my past, I wrote a story called Nothing, which is kind of the idea about a brain as a kind of self-deluding parasite that's just trying to further reproduction.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote a story called The Pain of Annihilation, although in German it's like Vermachtschlung or whatever.
Oh, definitely. It's got a much better name in German, as do all things.
About a being that promises a painless death as a cosmic sympathy. So, I mean, I have a kind of aesthetic sympathy for what he's getting across. Written out as supposed philosophy makes me a little less sympathetic. But I got this book when it came out in 2010, as I mentioned. I like to imagine a line of people waiting for the store to open, lining up to buy their copy, and then throwing themselves off cliffs like lemmings with the books in their hands. I had more of the sensibility maybe when I was younger, whereas I felt more that it was the nature of existence that caused my psychic problems, although now I realize it's more me, which you would think would increase my problems rather than decrease them, but it hasn't.
Yeah, you've gotten soft in your old age, what it's come down to.
A big problem with all this is it's completely non-falsifiable, you know what I mean? It's like, if you disagree, it's just like, well, it's just your self-deluding aspects of your consciousness is preventing you from understanding the paradox of your nature. And then you're like...
Yeah, I mean, the trouble with this is you can only think about it, if you exist, and by existing, you've already proved their point.
Yeah, supposedly. But so, the problem with the book, I mean, we're going to get into it. It's just like...
Oh, are we going to get into it?
Oh, we are. We're getting into it right now. I would just say the problem with the book as a... It's like I keep expecting there to be an argument. You know what I mean? It's not really like he's... like it's not like there's a premise and then he's trying to prove that premise. At least to me. Like, it's hard to find an argument to engage in. It's very slippery. He's just... to me, he just kind of assumed a lot of things, but... So it opens by this, has this foreword by a fellow named Ray Brossier, who is a professor somewhere. A very foppish foreword. He writes stuff like, "Disputants of the normative buoyancy of our race can expect to be chastised for their ingratitude, upbraided for their cowardice, patronized by their shallowness." Written in a kind of pompous way that, you know, you'd want to avoid this guy at a party. I kind of feel like everything written in this book. I imagine everyone wearing a bow tie while they're typing all this stuff out.
Yeah, a lot of this is, y'all have a conversation with you for 3 minutes, and then afterwards I'm like, I gotta go grab some more canapes, I'll be back, and then you never go back.
He calls this book the most sustained challenge to the intellectual blackmail, to be grateful for a gift for which we were never invited. No doubt people will think Ligotti argues in bad faith because he hasn't killed himself, but that's unfair because Ligotti, quote, avows the impossibility for the living to successfully evade life's grasp. Because if living is lying, then telling the truth about life's lie is a sublimated lie, which is something I will get to later, but I don't find convincing at all. Mm-hmm. Or in other words, we're paying for a book of lies.
How much?
Too much. So there's a poem that opens the book that I'm going to read very quickly. Ahem, my poetry voice. Look at your body, a painted puppet, a poor toy, of jointed parts ready to collapse, a diseased and suffering thing with a head full of false imaginings. That's also the book.
I mean, it's nice to sum it up so easily, right?
You could just read that poem from the Dhammapada, and that is kind of an abridged version of the book. It actually literally is.
Mm-hmm.
So the first chapter of Pessimism and Paradox.
Should we start with saying, I don't hate this book, it is just very hard to get through, and I think you're in the same?
Yeah, I mean, I don't hate it. I mean, I think there's a... Thomas Ligotti is a very... he's a good writer, and he has a dark, kind of clever sense of humor, and he has a good turns of phrases. I kind of like it more for its craftsmanship than any argument.
Yeah, like, there are a lot of good parts in this, for sure. It's just, I don't know if I... I think I just generally do not agree with the overall thing.
Yeah, I would say I'm not convinced.
Uh-huh.
I mean, through all this depressing shit he's writing about how, you know, life is malignantly useless, I was, like, eating a brisket sandwich, and I was like, yeah, that's pretty good.
Well, that brisket sandwich sounds worthless, but not useless. No, wait, useless but not worthless? Oh, boy.
I mean, either way, I was like, I'm enjoying eating the sandwich. You know? I'm enjoying it coming out, going down. I'm going to enjoy it coming out. I'm going to enjoy the whole time. So philosopher Julius Bahnsen, in 1847, when he was 17 years old, wrote, "Man is a self-conscious nothing. So we must all follow the lead of a 17-year-old and kill ourselves." Kidding, of course. "There is an ancient tradition of scorn for our species and its aspirations. But those sorts of things are never too popular for obvious reasons. In Bahnsen's view, everything is engaged in a disordered fantasia of carnage, chaos at feast, a festival of massacre." I don't disagree that that's the natural world of, like, you know, the whole nasty, brutish, and short Thomas Hobbes things.
Mm-hmm.
That's not how I really feel one engages or perceives our modern world. If anything, the modern world feels boring and isolating. Like, I mean, shit, a disordered fantasia of carnage sounds a hell of a lot more exciting than waking up to go to the office, you know what I mean?
Yeah, how many also weird fiction authors do you think just are going through this book and highlighting, oh, this will be a sweet collection title? That sounds good. That sounds good.
Awesome. I think I literally did that when I first got the book 10 years ago. I'm sure Disordered Fantasia of Carnage was one option for You Shall Never Know Security. He notes that these arguments are not too popular. You know, he says, "Those who have argued for a sullen appraisal of life might as well have never been born. Tee hee hee. given how unpopular they are, because living people are naturally biased toward living. So the book's main premise is taken from a philosopher to be discussed later, who argues that the evolution of consciousness is the parent of all horrors, the single calamitous event which creates a real-life paradox. Not a rhetorical paradox, but a real-life one. Mm-hmm. He then talks about there are some paradoxes that supernatural literature relies upon, such as the living dead, or the puppet that breaks free of its strings and becomes self-mobilized, i.e. 85% of all of Thomas Ligotti's stories. I don't know if you've read Thomas Ligotti too much, but he loves his puppets.
There are definitely a lot of puppet drops in this book as well.
Yeah, there's a lot of puppet drops in all of his fiction. The uncanny or supernatural seems almost necessarily to be horror, because they horrify us in concept, since we think of ourselves as living in a natural world, and a living puppet would affirm a metaphysics of chaos and nightmare, which is why Pinocchio is not a beloved children's classic, but reserved to mentally break inmates at Guantanamo Bay.
Well, that original Pinocchio story is apparently much more graphic and terrifying than the Disney version.
Hey man, you get eaten by a whale, it's pretty horrifying.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't care for that any a bit.
You're being enslaved by an old Italian man. That's horrible.
Even worse.
See, when I drink my coffee, how bad can life be?
Well, everyone who hates hearing eating and drinking noises.
Well,
quite bad.
They're already miserable people to begin with.
Misophonia?
Human puppets would not conceive of themselves as puppets, as for something with consciousness thinks of itself as its own master. We keep secret what is too terrible for us to know, naked apes or incarnate angels we may believe ourselves to be, but not human puppets. I don't know, I'd kind of want to be a human puppet instead of a naked ape. Is it fair? Yeah, so let's get to the next chapter. I mean, that's kind of a chapter. You're like, wait, what's the chapter? It's just him, like, extemporizing, which is...
Yeah, these chapters are interesting, and we'll get into that, I'm sure.
Well, the chapters don't build to... And they don't build upon each other.
Yeah.
They're all like, within each chapter, there are like these little sub-chapters, just this like, pessimism 3, being alone 5, you know?
Blundering, repression, yeah. Undoing 2. Was there an undoing 1? I don't know.
I mean, that's your own undoing, you're trying to find that. So the main, I guess the main meat of the rest of what we're going to talk about today is the nightmare of being. Or, as I like to think of it, will Ligotti get us to kill ourselves in 66 pages or less? We'll find out. So we get a little sort of fable, where we once existed without lives of our own. Everything seemed open to us, and we were one with nature. But then after generations, we shuddered at the vast stars, and felt like we should do something when we saw our dead brethren. We were separated from creation. I feel like citation needed, you know what I mean?
Yeah, there's a lot. It's like, he will bring up a thing, and I will go, oh, I'd like to know anything more about that other than what you've just written, or any sort of statistics involved with this. Is this even true, what you're writing here? No one knows.
Is there a handy explanation for the development of consciousness? I don't know if I ever believed that there was a time we felt we existed without lives of our own, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I guess what he means is that self-conscious awareness of ourselves makes us as a distinct person. But the whole idea of consciousness is so complicated that I don't really think there's any, like, agreed upon development of consciousness. I'm sure it came in, like, stages. It wasn't like, oh, one day we're like, wow, those stars are far away and intimidating.
It seems more like a scientifical comment than a philosophical one.
Definitely scientifical. Yeah. People usually say... So he keeps repeating this phrase that people usually say, being alive is all right, which doesn't really sound like a ringing endorsement. I mean, that's what I say when food is mediocre. I'm like, yeah, it's all right. But people often say, being alive is all right, and then say, better than the alternative. But is it? Is it? Because apparently being alive is to inhabit a nightmare without hope of awakening to a natural world, to have our bodies embedded neck deep in a quagmire of dread, to live in as shut-ins in a house of horrors from which nobody gets out alive. I kind of like to imagine you're like at a Denny's or like a fucking, what's that other?
A Waffle House?
Let's just stick at a Denny's. Yeah, I was gonna say a Waffle House or a Cracker Barrel.
Uh-huh.
And you're just like, hey man, what do you think about, you know, being who you are and being alive, and people be like, it's all right. And then you're like, it's a quagmire of dread. And they're just like eating their fucking, you know, mozzarella sticks.
The quagmire of dread slammer. Yeah. Now $7.99.
People are just like, pass the salt. You know, like, whatever.
You're like, the sodium in this food's already through the roof. Why do you need more salt?
That's fair. I mean, these are Denny's people. Mm-hmm. They live for the salt. There's a big salt lick outside. So one effort to expound upon all this, and which seems to be the basis for the entire book, is this essay called The Last Messiah by Norwegian philosopher Petel Wessel-Zopf, written in 1933, who I did note, the man lived for over 100 years, so I don't think he was so quick to wipe himself off this mortal coil.
Well, you will, as we will find later on, just because you're a pessimist doesn't mean you're a hypocrite if you don't kill yourself.
See, I don't know if I agree with that. I feel like
we'll get to that too, because I got some thoughts on that.
I feel like his arguments for that are pretty weak. Mm-hmm. The only natural birthright of any person is to die. No one has any other right allocated. Any other right allocated to you is a fabrication. Our want of a birthright, other than the right to die, is not a matter of tragedy, but of truth. The tragedy of human existence, according to Zopf, was the damning surplus of consciousness, which formed a breach in the unity of life, a biological paradox. I'm not really sure exactly why I guess I understand the point he's making about, like, we are the first animal to have this awareness, and the awareness of ourselves, and this perception of ourselves, and the awareness that we're going to die, the ability to understand time. But I don't exactly understand why that's a paradox.
I mean, also, is that true? Like, I know, yeah, we're the primary species on this planet, but I think via through tests with, you know, whales and dolphins and stuff, I mean, there's a self-awareness of animals, and I think there's like 10 animals that are self-aware, and there are also animals that feel more complex emotions. I mean, I guess it's hard to tell. Like, whales and dolphins will beach themselves en masse. Is that them trying to mass commit suicide?
Why do they do that?
And nobody knows. That's the thing.
I mean, squirrels have to have some concept of time because they know when to get those nuts in the tree.
Mm-hmm.
He says, this is Zopf speaking. He says, nature answers no more. It performed a miracle with man, but later do not know him. He has lost his right of residence in the universe, has eaten from the tree of knowledge, and had been expelled from paradise. He is mighty in the near world, but curses his might as purchased with his harmony of soul, his innocence, his inner peace in life's embrace. I guess the point he's trying to make is that other animals supposedly just follow their biological base urges without any greater consideration of time or the future or themselves, or the search for meaning, whereas we are cursed with that. Although talking about time, I do remember my dog, you know, he'd take a shit and then I'd like walk in it and I'd be like, I bet he planted that right where I was gonna walk. He was mad at me. I saw his face. He was plotting that shit. But hey, this other philosopher, Nicholas Humphrey, says, hey, consciousness, it's actually pretty cool. So who knows who's right, right?
I mean, isn't that every philosophical argument?
Yeah, it's like, this guy says this, somewhere in the middle, probably.
Exactly.
Consciousness makes the world appear to us as it appears, and makes us appear to ourselves as we appear, as quote-unquote persons, strung together by memories, sensations, emotions, and so on. Yeah, again, I kind of wish there was a discussion about consciousness, because that's pretty fascinating. And I know, like, you know, primates and octopus and dolphins and birds, they have limited consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
So why do people not go crazy under the strain of conscious living? Because of the ability to artificially the limit of its content. Consciousness made us into contradictory beings, uncanny things that have nothing to do with the rest of creation, susceptible to thoughts that were startling and dreadful, never balanced by thoughts that are reassuring. Human beings are the only animal with a conception of existence, that there is a brotherhood of suffering. Well, and I was thinking, if Ligotti doesn't change his paternalistic language, he's going to be in a world of suffering in the here and now. He also mentioned something in a footnote that kind of was strange. Like, he mentioned, did you read that part where he was talking about that guy who was like an anti-Semite?
No.
He mentioned some, like, one of the philosophers in a footnote, and he's talking about, like, the Holocaust and, like, Hitler. And he says in the footnote, he's like, The Holocaust, quote, did not cause the way of life of his target group to falter, in contrast to what the Americans did to the indigenous. Although I was thinking, like, I think those 6 million dead Jews might disagree about whether that caused their life to falter.
Yeah, there's a lot in this book that seems like it could have been written 30 years ago instead of 10 years ago.
Yeah,
it's a little dated at this point. Ooh.
Although Ligotti, you know, according to it, Ligotti, Hitler might have been a great humanitarian, because think of all those people he allowed to not be born, you know?
Mm.
We are the only beings that understand suffering, and we cannot give suffering precedence because you have to get on with things, and those who bother us with their sniveling, aka the Ligottis of the world, get left behind. You might conceive of yourself as a biological paradox, cannot live with your consciousness, can't live without it, like a human puppet or the undead. So like Derek, one day you will die.
Yeah. Can't wait.
It'll probably be unpleasant.
Undoubtedly. Might
be painful. You'll probably suffer.
For sure. Uh-huh.
What are your thoughts on that?
It's going to happen.
Why does that not
cause... What do you want me to do about it? I mean, should I just curl up in bed for the rest of my horrible life? Worrying about this? No, you gotta live it.
Why doesn't this cause us to collapse?
I mean, it is like an abstraction, yes.
Yeah.
So I think that's it. As a chapter we'll get to later on about how we repress all this stuff so we can get through the day.
I feel like I might find his argument sort of more convincing of, like, if death wasn't guaranteed and it was like you'd only die if you really fuck something up.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea of, like, well, you're going to die anyway. So what the fuck is the point of... I'm being a little bit hypocritical because you worry about death all the time. Right? You know, if you get sick, you're like, fuck, I'm going to die.
Yeah.
The idea that I'm going to die or not exist doesn't strike me with such terrible fear of, like, quivering in my fucking brain. You know what I mean?
Well, that's got to be part of your biology, right?
Yeah.
Otherwise, so. Everything with a conscience would be crippled by this.
Yeah. I mean, I used to be, when I was younger, I used to wish I was like a dog, you know?
So you can die in 7 years?
No, I just meant, ever see a panting dog just like laying on a heating vent in the winter?
I have not.
Pretty fucking contented.
Uh-huh.
So the tragedy is that we know we will die, and consciousness has forced us into the paradoxical position of striving for meaning, to be more than hunks of spoiling flesh on disintegrating bones. Unless you're a Swedish metal band stealing that name right there. Also, is it true that non-humans are unaware of death? I mean, I know they can't conceive of time, but, like, why does a prey run from its predator unless it's aware of pain and death?
Yeah, and you get elephants mourn their dead and whales mourn their dead as well.
And I mean, I imagine, like, being a fucking rabbit must be much more fucking terrifying than being a human being.
Mm-hmm.
And being an eagle must be pretty fucking sweet. So life is a confidence trick we play on ourselves to prevent us from staring into the silent void, and to end the self-deception, we must cease reproducing. As for Zapf, who argues, no future triumph or metamorphosis can justify the pitiful blighting of a human being against his will. It is a pavement of battered destinies that the survivors storm ahead toward new bland sensations and mass deaths. To Zapf, there are four main ways we limit our consciousness, which is looking at this and like, hey, this is 99.99% of my entire life. There's isolation. Don't think about it. Isolate the dire facts and compartmentalize. Anchoring. Think of God, morality, natural law, family, other things which make us feel safe and authentic and happy. 3, distraction. That's like 99% of my limits on consciousness.
Agreed.
Listening to podcasts. The world of trifling trash. What's new on Amazon Prime? Sublimation. Sublimate our fears by making an open display of them through pale imitation and bogus simulations. I.e., check out my fourth collection. You know it's true. Out now. I don't really see how isolation, anchoring, and distraction are not just differences by degree. I mean, they're all the same shit. If you're isolating...
Yeah, but two anchors doesn't sound very good. Four anchors sounds like you've got something.
But like, when he says like anchoring is like... It's like one is distracting, one is anchoring. Anchoring is like, think of God and natural law, blah, blah, blah. Distraction is like, watch TV. But with anchoring, you're just distracting yourself with concepts rather than like a movie.
An actual thing.
The same shit. Then there's a little digression about this 23-year-old philosopher named Carlo Mockelstader, who thought about some of these tactics, and he cannot tolerate this paradox of our division from ourselves, and he killed himself the day after he finished his dissertation. The farther you move away from these conditions, you would be aware of the falsity of yourself and the subject us to the pain of Pinocchio.
I think the problem was someone was listening to a 23-year-old and taking them seriously.
That's true. I mean, so far he's quoted a 17-year-old and a 23-year-old, so it's a little bit of a problem. Another digression is about the idea we should stop reproducing brings up a Gnostic sect of the Cathari in 12th century France who were only allowed abstinence or anal. That's like, you know, Diet Coke or fucking heroin. Those are like quite the spectrum there.
I mean, isn't that just the abstinent movement today?
They do anal?
Yeah, because that's not losing your virginity.
Really?
According to the film Sex Drive, yes.
And apparently there was another sect that called themselves the Bogomils, which was the origin of the term buggery. Here, I thought that was based on the ways that flies fuck. This also might be the first philosophical tract that uses the term bungholes. Did you notice that?
Circle that. Like, what about the great philosopher Beavis and Butthead?
That's true. Well, they were more of the oral tradition of a Socrates. They didn't write down their works. Another philosopher, Philip Mainlander, inverts Schopenhauer's idea of a will to live to a will to die. He said once people had obtained something like, you know, peace on earth and charity across the earth, they would realize non-existence was preferable. And then on the day his book Philosophy of Redemption was published, he killed himself. So maybe the police and social services should track down the proposed publication dates for depressing philosophers, because it seems like when people are producing these books or these dissertations, they kill themselves. He said, "Life is hell, and the sweet still night of absolute death is the annihilation of hell."
I mean, that does sound pretty nice.
He cannot be reached for comment. Ligotti says that if existence had redeeming qualities, there would be no need for the idea of an afterlife or a progress toward perfection. I don't know if that's true, because existence could have redeeming qualities, and then it would be fucking sweet to have a perfect afterlife.
Mm-hmm.
So this kind of all leads us to the idea of meaning, which is uniquely human seeking. And just look at all the self-help books out there. In the quest for a sense of meaning, humanity has given countless answers to questions that were never posed to it. And it seems our questing is never satisfied. The pursuit always resumed. Ligotti says it's better to think of existence rather than life, as we all have just a certain amount of years of existence, and the term existence unclothes the word of its mystique. I think things are overstated over and over when he calls us like unreality on legs. Since we cannot live without self-deception and ignore our unwinnable situation in the world, or perhaps that's just my self-deception going into overdrive. Or perhaps it just shows we have the mighty power blessed with the inborn ability to handle it. When he keeps talking about like unreality on legs, a parrot, like some of the language is so purple and overinflated. I just think like, well, this doesn't really seem to reflect my life as I live it. I'd love to be a paradox on legs or an unreality. That's pretty much more interesting than sitting around quarantined all day.
I mean, perhaps the problem is you're limiting your life by not using more purple prose to describe what you're going through.
That's true. He then discusses that optimists and pessimists both cling to whatever validates their emotions and thoughts. And even a pessimist in ecstasy would agree that existence was undesirable. But what about a pessimist on ecstasy? I mean, in terms of optimist versus pessimist, I always thought it was always half glass full or empty, not should this glass even exist? He acknowledges that pessimism is an ideal that no one can ever follow to the letter, and the reason why people are the way they are is a mystery, and if there's a genetic component to it, naturally it will be bred out as maladaptive. The majority of humanity can undergo trauma without re-examining the worth of living and reproduction, whereas pessimists feel they have been impressed into this world by the reproductive liberty of positive thinkers, against their will. And there is a curious thought that at every moment in time, people would think, given whatever advances in technology or science there have been, that this is the best time in history to have children. Whereas the pessimist says that there is never a good time to do so, which is why the pessimists end up alone listening to our podcast or producing this podcast and not at the cool kid parties. Derek, you're up.
All right, so we've got your two groups, your optimists and your pessimists, and there's apparently no in-between here. So, sure, I don't know about that, but okay, well, let's take that as our premise. Lugatis thinks that a pessimist who doesn't kill themselves is not a hypocrite, which, and then he goes to like, oh, if you think that, you know, just because someone's a pessimist, you're a fucking idiot for thinking that. Like, I don't necessarily agree with that. You can be a pessimist about a lot of things and still be like, I guess I don't really need to die here. But I guess in his theory, that would make you an optimist and therefore not a pessimist. So pessimists sound like the worst of the worst, terrible people you'd never want to have a conversation with. And optimists sound like 98% of the rest of the population.
Yeah. Pessimists are pretty extreme in his estimation.
Yeah, I mean, there doesn't seem to be a lot of half measures here.
I always thought pessimists being like, yeah, I probably won't get that job. Not like, I want you all to be annihilated.
Yeah, no, in his look, that's an optimist right there.
Yeah.
However, any optimist that kills themselves was not an optimist to begin with, but in fact a pessimist. So, sure, okay. Which doesn't seem to take into account like any sort of, hey, something super bad in your life happened, or you have some sort of mental illness or anything like that that could cause you to kill yourself, unrelated to the rest of your outlook lifestyle.
Yeah, it's not really mental illness doesn't really take into account in any of this.
No, definitely not at all. I mean, I think this is what makes this feel as though it was written longer ago than it was.
Yeah.
Hey, is existence a joke we blundered into?
I mean, I didn't blunder anything. I was just born.
So existence exists because of consciousness. I guess, yes.
Well, I think consciousness is what gives us our conception of ourselves and our existence.
Of existence?
Yeah.
And the world would be better off without us, for sure.
I don't know if that's true. I mean, maybe
what if human beings done that would not make that the case?
You mean for the Earth as a whole?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but then he says, who cares about what the Earth thinks? Because the Earth is the one that created consciousness, so fuck.
Well, I mean, that's a little bit later on. He's just like, oh yeah, we can totally destroy the Earth because the Earth, we're the Earth's problem. The Earth shouldn't have made us if it didn't want us to wreck it.
Well, I would say that outside of what we have done to the Earth, there's a value in our own existence that, like, we shouldn't have to compare what we've done to for how we benefit other species.
Yeah, I mean, like, we have really only made accomplishments for human beings. No, well, yeah. Nothing else cares that we exist. And if
what
anything,
the fuck
we
are dolphins doing for us?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I guess you have those mind-finding rats now. That's our fun.
I mean, actually, recently we've allowed other, you know, endangered species to flourish.
Why are these species endangered?
They didn't want to fuck anymore.
Because of human beings being around.
They read too much Thomas Ligotti.
Yeah. Also quite possible. Yeah. No, I mean, I think like the only way that I can say that human beings are a positive for the Earth is if there was some sort of asteroid on the way that would destroy the Earth and human beings blow it up before it gets here to save the Earth.
Yeah, but I also don't think that we have to prove ourselves to the rest of the Earth.
Well, I mean, that's good because we're doing a terrible job at that.
Sounds like you're on pro-Ligotti and humanity side, Derek.
I don't know if human beings being around is the best thing. I think we could lose most people and be okay with that.
Yeah, that's just because they're slow drivers and they bump into me on the sidewalk.
Mm-hmm. And they wait in line when I'm trying to go to the bank because you can't go into the bank anymore. So now I gotta wait 45 minutes in line because someone wants to have a conversation with the teller and there's only one drive-up window.
Derek, let's raise our hands. Who's the one who actively chopped down trees?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's me. I did chop down some trees. Yeah, hundreds and hundreds of trees. I mean, you don't know what those trees
did.
In the
tree chattel trade.
Well, technically, I never cut down any of those trees. I just peddled mutilated trees.
That's
Is that better?
Tongue twister.
But getting back to this. So, Schopenhauer summarizes pessimism as, behind the scenes of life, there is something pernicious that makes a nightmare of our world. And Ligotti kind of ties that into, this is the sort of the premise of all horror stories. And talk about Blackwood and M.R. James and Machen and Chambers and Poe and our boy Lovecraft. He brings up a Lovecraft story where he was writing a letter to someone where the guy was like, oh, I want to write this story about a man who wants to train germs to kill everybody off so he can take over the planet. And Lovecraft's like, yeah, that's kind of lame. You should make it he just wants to destroy all life. Which, agreed, that's a much better story. But I guess the premise of some men just want to watch the world burn was not really a thing until some point.
Although, meanwhile, Lovecraft is enjoying his historical towns and Americana and cats, you know?
Yeah, I mean, like, he goes from being a cosmic pessimist to kind of a cosmic indifferentalist.
Although, that's, I don't agree with that. I thought he was always an indifferent.
Well, I guess if you go by the, you're either a pessimist or you're an optimist, and there's no in-between, and pessimists are only hate everything, then yeah, Lovecraft was not a pessimist.
The problem is like, Lovecraft wrote 14 trillion letters, so of course you can find a couple where he's extremely cynical and unhappy.
Yeah, when we have literally 30 years of writing to look at. Surprise, surprise, people's opinions change over 30 years.
I mean, he was an indifferentist in the sense that he was like, I don't think he ever thought that, like, the cosmos were malevolent toward humanity. They were just indifferent toward us. Like, he's a man who had his interests and his diversions and his illusions of sorts that kept him, you know, interested in the world.
Yeah, he loved a half mango cut in half, or a honeydew melon cut in half with a scoop of coffee ice cream inside it.
It's pretty fucking good, man.
Is it? That sounds pretty terrible.
I mean, it sounds
interesting. I'm not a honeydew melon fan, so I'm out already. Coffee ice cream, though, I'll be on that.
There's something called a dino melon you got to try sometime. It's pretty good.
The dino melon?
It looks like that because it kind of looks like a dinosaur egg. It's like splotchy on the outside.
Like a Yoshi egg?
I wouldn't go that far. More like a Jurassic Park egg.
Okay.
So it's like a giant very egg, sweet it's melon. It's good. They're from Brazil.
Mm-hmm. Not a big melon fan. Not even a watermelon.
You know, actually, the closest I am towards understanding Ligeti's paradox of consciousness probably has to do with sexuality, because, you know, we have these inborn urges, sexual urges, that we didn't ask for, you know what I mean? It's just like you respond to, your genetics or whatever it is that you respond to the stimulus. That, to me, stuff like that was always the biggest indicator that there is something that, like, if he wants to talk about human puppet, you know, that is like, that's kind of, I guess it's the will to live, the will to reproduce, you know, the will that acts through us. And there is something I think is like, you don't have any choice over that. And there is a feeling of like being dragged along by your impulses.
Yeah.
Like to me, the biggest feeling I would always have of like being in this kind of paradox would be like your sexual urges while also having disgust toward the physical body. Cause then you're really in the mire right there. You know?
Your id's telling you one thing, but your ego's telling you another?
Yeah, but that's just like, you're attracted, and then you're like, ew, poop.
Yes, just like that.
Exactly.
Yeah. Am I happy? True or false? People apparently say happy more often. Where's the stats? Give me the figures. I mean, like, this is the one, like, are you just saying this? What do you have to back this up? What percentage are we talking here?
Wait, are you saying people are happy, or are you?
No, this is from the book.
Oh, okay.
He questions, you know, he says, when people are asked, are they happy, true or false, most people say, yeah, they're happy more often than not, which is probably true. I mean, it sounds reasonable, but if you're going to make a grand sweeping statement like that, let's back it up with some stuff here.
Yeah, I feel like most people would probably say they feel happy most of the time, but they also probably wouldn't want to reveal their innermost thoughts.
Yeah, it's you get biased answers however you do it.
Sorry, it's reading some of this when he's talking about, like, when you're talking about the will to live and stuff, he's like, the pessimist acknowledges the will to live as a life force, but not the things activated by it. They act out their roles as wind-up toys, which I also thought was probably a sentiment that's probably read in, like, the jury sentencing of many mass killers. You know? He says, like, here's a quote, they are only puppets, and if they have consciousness, they mistakenly believe they are a self-winding person who are making a go of it on their own.
Yeah, like, this is not far from a serial killer manifesto, right?
Yeah, is that from this book or from the Journal of the B2K Killer?
Exactly. It's like, oh, was this one of those things in John Doe's apartment in 7? Quite possibly. He goes off a bit on Zappa talking about, oh, I feel okay, but let's ask my brother who never existed. How's he doing? And I had a good little chuckle about that. That's pretty good. But then it kind of brings up the grand thing, like, okay, to be or not, but in order to make that decision, you must be to begin with. So our stats are kind of juked to begin with, which I guess is the problem with if you are only people with consciousness can talk about whether it's better to not have consciousness. You can't ask the brother that never existed how they're doing when it gets to real life, right?
Yeah, they don't exist.
Exactly.
Why does he assume it's a brother?
I mean, it's just the instance that he used for this the tale that he told.
Okay.
So, I mean, he probably, via that logic, he would have sisters that were never born either. That's true. Can't debate it. The repression section kind of deals with the, we were talking about earlier about how humans need to, you know, repress certain ideas just to get through the day and function and, you know, that kind of thing, which I think kind of brings up my whole thought of philosophy. Like, yeah, I just don't care about most of this stuff. So, cool, here we are. But I guess that's not so much repression as just like, hey, I've thought about it. This impacts my life none. This is not going to make my life better thinking about it. If anything, I'll just turn to a crazy neurotic. So why bother with it?
He mentions the philosopher David Benatar, who argued in a book, Better to Never Have Been, that because some amount of suffering is inevitable for those who are born, but the absence of happiness does not deprive those who are not born. The scales are tipped in favor of not reproducing. I was thinking, man, I hope Mr. Benatar wrote that book after his parents had passed away. Imagine being Benatar Sr. and reading that.
Yeah, non-existence never hurt anyone, but existence hurts everyone.
Yeah, I actually got that book out of the library like 10 years or so ago after I was reading this book. And I thought, I remember I caught myself and I was like, what am I doing? Like, why why am I reading this? Like, what is the point of this? It's kind of like when I was younger, I remember I used to buy like a book on atheism and I like reading it and I'm like, but I'm like, if I'm already an atheist, who the fuck am I arguing? I'm not like going to the town square and arguing with people.
Yeah, like, you're just sitting there reading it going, yeah, yeah, this guy totally gets me, yeah.
Like, what? Yeah, what is the... I'm not furthering anything in reading this.
Mm-hmm.
So.
He kind of brings up the idea that staying alive is a sickness with humans, which, I mean, I think that's a good premise for a short story right there, and that our lifespans for non-domesticated animals have never increased while humans are, you know, two or threefold, which... I, again, would like to know if that is true or not, whether any other animals have had their lifetime, I mean, non-domesticated, have had their lifetimes increased over the course of time. My guess would be yes, but I also can't point to any specific example. I guess things that mooch off of humans, like a raccoon who digs through your trash, they probably have better lives now than they did before trash. Pizza rat, New York native, he wouldn't be chowing down a pizza if there were any humans.
Yeah, but I mean... He died like a hero. He didn't live like a hero.
Well, I mean, I can't imagine how much, what percentage of cheese to blood ratio he was after eating that whole thing.
That's true.
He definitely a useless one. Yeah. We get into the argument of useless versus worthless, with worthlessness having kind of a judgment to it. So let's just say useless to everything, and how a afterlife is or useful while alive because A, it's something to look forward to, but once you are dead, then what's the point of an afterlife? I guess the thought of, you know, an eternity of pleasure is just not worth it at that point. Like, you get up to heaven and everything's there that you want, and you're like, oh, okay, this is it forever now. Kill yourself.
I guess so.
Yeah. We get into again about how, you know, where the planet's fault. So if we're jacking it up, the planet totally deserves it. And like I was saying, yeah, humans have really done nothing to improve the planets. That wouldn't have been better without them being there until this asteroid comes that we save.
I guess there's this argument that blind nature created our consciousness problem, so fuck it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, pretty much, which I don't know why people aren't using that as anti-environmentalist slogans right there.
Yeah, it doesn't fit on a poster board.
Yeah, it's hard to march without a sign.
Yeah.
We get to the end of the Zapha's Last Messiah, and it turns out it ends with the Last Messiah saying, hey, everybody, stop reproducing. And he is torn to bits by pacifier manufacturers and midwives, which I think makes me wonder if maybe that story isn't funnier than this book makes it out to seem.
Yeah, I mean, you don't want to fuck with the pacifier maker lobby.
Big pacifier? Don't want to mess with them.
I also don't imagine back in ye olde Messiah times there were too many pacifier makers, but
yeah, probably not, but you just sucked on a rock and that was it and you liked it.
There must have been some irony in that essay of his.
Yeah, what's the Jonathan Swift where he encourages people to, you get rid of poverty by eating all the poor people?
Like the Irish people, right?
Yeah, I think it was something like that. And it's like, all right, this is satire, which I wouldn't have guessed that up until now. But maybe it's not. Maybe it's played totally seriously. But if it was written by a, 17-year-old who lived to be 100, who can say?
Who can say?
He talks a bit about the Canadian scientist Michael Pershing, who made a motorcycle helmet that shoots magnetic waves into your brain to give you religious and supernatural experiences. And I thought that sounded awesome. And I looked it up, and it looks like literally a motorcycle helmet with some wires on it. So don't be shocked. Apparently it does. But Pershing's kind of interesting in that he's not actually Canadian. He's from Jacksonville, Florida. And in 2016, he was removed from teaching because he made his Psych 101 class sign a statement that he'd be using swears, homophobic slurs, and offensive slang about genitalia, and they better get used to it.
Like, just because that's his personality, or that have anything to do with the class?
Wikipedia didn't go into it too much, but in Psych 101, probably just his personality.
Damn.
But in 2016, you know, can't really be doing that.
Maybe despite like, here's my rule. If you get a C, I call you this word. You got a B-, you're this word.
Uh-huh. So the idea of the God helmet sounds very interesting, and so this was developed in the 80s, I guess, and I'm surprised we have not heard more about it now.
Surprised even I can't just go like, buy that. That sounds awesome.
Yeah, just like, you know, that seems like something you find in the Sharper Image catalog. Like, oh, put this on, we'll shoot magnetic waves into your brain, and then you can see the face of God.
Although maybe they haven't, like, everyone who used it became a fucking vegetable or something.
Again, Wikipedia not super helpful with all
this. So does this support or detract from his thesis? Because some might argue that, hey, we have an inborn awareness of higher powers and this, you know.
Yeah, that kind of goes into the next chapter in that, so he made the God helmet and then said, see, religion doesn't exist. It's all just your brain doing stuff. And then the other side was like, oh no, this exists because we can find religion. And he's just tapped into it, but you know, it's there. And the next chapter kind of deals with, all right, does it matter that thoughts and behavior are due to neural wiring and hereditary rather than personal control over individuality, which I don't think this book gives an answer to at all. And also, if the end result is the same, do we really care? Should we care about this?
No.
And he doesn't really seem to have an answer to this, but it kind of goes into the, well, scientists are looking into it, and it calls back the quote I was looking up earlier that I told JR from the beginning of Call of Cthulhu, where the scientists, each straining its own direction, have hitherto harmed us little, but someday the piecing together of disassociated knowledge will open up such terrifying vistas of reality and of our frightening position therein that we should either go mad from the revelation or flee in the deadly light into the peace and safety of a new dark age. So if scientists can prove at some point, like now it's still iffy, and no one cares. But if one point the scientists can prove one way or another, hey, yep, human beings, we just exist and it's pain, or nah, everything's fine. Like, are we going to make a decision at that point? Are people still going to say, we just don't care? And I'm thinking it's probably the we don't care.
One argument he made when he touched a little bit about the argument, like, hey, aren't pessimists hypocrites if they don't just kill themselves? And his first response is like, oh, that displays such a crass intellect that it does not deserve a response.
Yeah.
But I'm like, wait, why? You're the one who's saying people should stop breeding. So I don't think posing the response that, hey, you know, that's crass, doesn't sound like a response. And he says, you know, simply because someone has reached the conclusion that the amount of suffering in this world is enough that anyone would be better off never having been born, does not mean that by force of logic or sincerity he must kill himself. It only means he has concluded that the amount of suffering in this world is enough that anyone would be better off having never been born. But taking that argument to its extension, what if there was a completely painless way of dying? Like, where you wouldn't know when or how you're going to die? Wouldn't it be moral to sign someone up for that service if you're thinking that consciousness is pain?
Yeah, I mean, sort of the taboo of suicide where, yeah, I wouldn't recommend it for people, but again, maybe that's your best, you think that's the best option for you at that point. And we, as a society, treat anyone who thinks they would rather be dead than alive is a crazy person who needs help, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And even religion is like, oh, hey, heaven's fantastic, it's way better on earth. And everyone would be like, well, I'll just kill myself to go there. And they're like, but if you kill yourself, you don't get to go there. What a twist.
But I don't get why Legati is saying that that's not hypocritical if you're saying life is hell and it's a paradox and unreality and legs and suffering. But if the response is then, if someone's like, why don't you just kill yourself? He's like, well, you know, you don't have to naturally go to that conclusion. You're just saying that it's better to never been born.
Mm-hmm.
I guess he's saying something along the lines of like your consciousness might prevent you from killing yourself. And then he also talks about like affirmative acts. He's like, it's difficult to make an affirmative act, even of killing yourself. You know, only catatonics and coma patients can persevere in a dignified withdrawal from life's rattle and hum. You know, you can't get away from being alive. But I don't really buy it. If he really believes so sincerely that being alive is such a terrible curse and a paradox and unreality on legs, and he's going to die eventually, there is a way out.
I mean, especially when his version, it's either, if you care about anything, you seem to be an optimist, otherwise you're a pessimist. Like, in the version where a pessimist doesn't care about anything, there's nothing in life worth holding on to. Why not at that point, right?
Yeah, I just don't really understand how extending to the end of his logical train doesn't lead to, like, well, it's better just kill yourself then.
Mm-hmm.
Unless
it's like, oh, well, if I had the choice between not existing and existing, I'd pick not existing. But now that I'm existing, pizza's pretty good, so here I am.
Or maybe he's saying something like, well, there's additional fear of then knowing you're going to die and the pain of it and blah, blah, blah. But isn't it better then than just going through your life waiting? I mean, doesn't he have, actually hurt, doesn't he have some kind of, like, completely debilitating illness now?
Oh, I don't know. I just know he's, like, a weird recluse now.
I think he was always a weird recluse. What do you think he wasn't? What do you think he was doing? Fucking conga lines at parties?
Well, there's that the Laird Barron story where he's up giving speeches and talking with puppets.
That's true. Is he actually literally talking with puppets?
He literally talks through a puppet.
Oh, what is he, a fucking, like, I didn't know he would say it's such an act, you know?
Well, maybe he gave it up after that, and that's why he became a recluse.
So, what, are you done with your section?
I am done with my section.
So what do you think so far?
So I listened to this book originally off of Audible, which I think is the better way to go.
Who read it?
Nobody, it's not like, oh, Tom Hanks read this. No, it's just some voice.
Whatever you're going to say, I thought it would be like the show name of the miserable person who read it. Like, oh, it was read by no one you know. And that's like a stage act name.
I mean, that is true, but however, not the case. But no, I think that's the reading this gave me a lot of flashbacks to college philosophy classes where this became quite a slog and I had to go through it multiple times and I did not care for that. But if you listen to it, it just kind of like washes over you. And I think it goes down smoother, let's say.
Hmm.
So I am not looking forward to finishing this book up, despite the fact that I like this book, but the work behind it, I mean, this is work, is what it feels like.
It kind of feels a little bit like, I wonder, even though I've read ahead,
mm-hmm.
I'm like, well, how can he keep going on for another two-thirds? Like, what's the other two-thirds of this going to be?
Yeah, I mean, like, this seems like a good start, but everything seems to be just reinforcing that or re-saying the same thing. So is there going to be a big twist coming up in part two?
Like, I would really actually be interested in if he went through a collection, maybe went more into Lovecraft or some other writers and just talked about how these themes appear in their work.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be interested in that.
Yeah, I think it is easier to, if you have real-world examples from stories, latch onto that as opposed to, oh, this 17-year-old philosopher said this, and this 23-year-old guy said this from 100 years ago. Oh, that's less interesting.
Yeah, I mean, he kind of does that a little bit with the Willows. And.
Yeah, I mean, that's the part that I liked.
Yeah, which I still have to read. I've never read the Willows, I know.
What are you doing? Well, I know a pick for you. Come next short story.
Yeah, but everyone's covered the Willows.
But you haven't read it.
That's true. So I guess we'll keep on plugging through if we make it.
Yep, if we don't find a suicide booth.
If they still can overcome our resistance.
Yeah.
This is our distraction. That's a painful one.
Adios.